this is the beginning of the second retreat, those of you who are continuing on from the first can renew your 8 precepts. And for those who have just come, I will go through these 8 precepts again and then give them to you formally. Can you hear? Is it all set up for your... You're all wired up?
Yes, I am.
Now, for those of you who were on the previous retreat, it's a good time also to reflect on just the form of the 8 precepts, as a to see how it, to see what you've learned from it so far. Now we're using for the meditation retreat, what the kind of precepts that are conducive towards spiritual development, in which your attention is directed inward rather than, say, your attention being pulled outward all the time. Now, most of the time, our lives are constant kind of being pulled out of ourselves to look at this, listen to that, read, watch television, eat, talk with people, and our mind, you see, is being pulled outward into objects. Like if you go sightseeing, you'll feel your attention always being pulled out by the scenery. You listen to music or talk, chat, read books, all this, your consciousness is being absorbed into objects of sense. Now for meditation, the goal of our practice for Buddhist meditation is Nibbana. Now Nibbana, or Nirvana, sounds terribly kind of exotic or impossible for those of you who might have read about it in a book or heard the word, but what it really means is the unconditioned, which is something that we don't look for outside. We won't be able to see it with our eye, or it's not a sound that you hear with the organ of your ear, or smell, taste, touch, or create with your mind. So, the practice of inclining to Nibbana means that we prepare ourselves in a way in which our senses will be as little stimulated, in which we will be able to, say, concentrate our attention, compose ourselves on what's going on inside our mind. So our meditation practice is more like an inner listening, watching. So we want as little kind of sensory distraction as possible, just for this 10-day retreat. So we don't watch television, listen to the radio, we don't read books, we keep a noble silence, and we don't have to talk or entertain each other with fascinating, interesting conversations. We don't have to seek each other for romantic affairs. We aren't getting caught up in playing games. We aren't going to play football, tennis, ping pong or anything. Bridge, chess, poker. we're not going to eat all day long. We have a certain designated meal time. And so we don't have to go around trying to look for something to eat. And refrain from going to the pub or the beer hall or taking drugs such as marijuana, heroin, and opium, LSD, these kind of things. Drugs that we could easily escape, get our consciousness off into when we get bored with looking at what's going on in our minds. Sometimes when you have to sit with yourself without anything to do, it can be pretty miserable. To have to be with your own mind for a while. You'd rather be with somebody else's mind or something that is more interesting than our own particular habits and conditions. But in this practice also we're developing a firm patience and ability to endure. So we have to endure things that before we wouldn't endure, where we would tend to run away and escape into something else. Now we're going to try to at least endure a little longer. We're going to stay in certain postures so that we're not going to try to seek comfort all the time, but just sitting comfortably but not luxuriously, sleeping but not just escaping into sleep all the time, certain times to sleep, sitting, standing, walking, basic postures, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. We're going to practice the concentration on our own breath, normal breath, recognizing our postures of sitting, standing, walking, lying down, and keeping these precepts. Now, the first, when I give these precepts, it's in the Pali language, so I will explain them to you so that you will know what you're saying, what you're vowing. And so, first of all, we chant the salutation to the Buddha, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sambuddhassa, which means a kind of praise, salutation to the Arahant, the Blessed One. It's a traditional Theravada kind of salutation before anything begins. Then you take the three refuges. The traditional way of being a Buddhist is taking the three refuges, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I take refuge in Buddha, in the Dhamma, and in the Sangha. Say, Bhutang Sarnangacchami, Tammang Sarnangacchami, Sanghang Sarnangacchami. Saranang Gacchami means refuge. And Bhutang, Tammang, Sanghang, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. So taking refuge in Buddha, you say Bhutang Saranangacchami, this is you're taking refuge in wisdom. Now, taking refuge in wisdom means using wisdom. So this is the whole point of this retreat, really, is to use wisdom in it, not to just kind of sit here in a habitual manner and wait for something to kind of zap you from outside and enlighten you, but it's to for you to arouse wisdom in your practice during this time. So taking refuge in Buddha means to, it's a very practical thing, it's not just a kind of exotic oriental phrase in which you repeat just for the sake of tradition, but it actually has an important meaning. It's a reflection, a recollection for you to remind yourself to be wise, to take refuge in wisdom. Then Tammang Saranangacchami, Dhamma, is the truth. The the word dhamma or dharma, the ultimate reality. Now that's not something separate either. So when you take refuge in dhamma, you're not exactly taking refuge in some belief in a supreme being, but in the truth here and now, because the dhamma, the ultimate truth, is immanent now. So it's a verbal recognition of the ultimate reality that is immanent now in all of us. So that the dhamma, or the ultimate truth, the Buddha is the personification of wisdom, and dhamma has no personification, has no personal qualities. Buddha, you see, they can make Buddha images, they can make them look like human beings, like, see, this little image is shaped like a human being. They can't make dharma images. They can't make a dharma, well, they use symbols like wheels or various symbols that kind of mean dharma, but they're never personifications, they're not beings of any sort. Then Sanghaṃ Saraṇaṃ in the Sangha means, Sangha means those who practice the Dhamma, those who live by the Dhamma, those who take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, like you and like myself, human beings, men and women, who practice the teaching of the Buddha are called the Sangha. The Sangha means those who practice virtue, who live a good life practicing what is good, doing good, refraining from doing evil, who are sincere in what they're doing and earnest. So you're taking refuge in that, in yourself also, which is sincere and good and earnest, not that in you which is foolish, worried, frightened, greedy, and so forth. You're not taking refuge in those things, you're taking refuge in a practical way, reminding yourself to use courage, goodness, diligence, all these, for your practice of meditation. In practical situations as being a human being living here at this, in this place, in this country. So Sanghaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi means taking refuge in that in yourself which is virtuous and good. So the refuges are merely ways of reminding ourselves to seek our refuge in wisdom, truth, and virtue. Rather than seeking our refuge, people generally seek refuge now in Swiss banks, in modern technology, refuge in others, seeking safety or security in some kind of relationship to someone else. Seeking refuge in worries. People will just spend all day worrying. But these are all very inadequate refuges. They're not refuges. Refuges are safe places to be, and those aren't safe. They always lead to despair, sorrow, death. So the three refuges of the Buddhist are truly refuges, places of safety. Now, the eight precepts begin with Bhānādibhāta, which means refrain from intentionally killing anyone. So during these next 10 days, if you'll kindly refrain from killing anybody here. Otherwise you'll break the precept. But also it means intentionally killing being, so don't kill the rats, the ants, the flies, the cats, or any other. So refrain from intentionally killing. Then the second is refraining from taking anything that is not given. So not to steal, not to take, not even to look at, touch other people's possessions. So, you know, just remember to kind of not to just leave things alone unless you know there's something that you really need and ask for it, or if it's yours, or if it's part of the community, but to refrain from even, like, if you're sharing rooms, to just borrow or take things that belong to other people, even though you have no intention of stealing, just refrain from just touching things that belong to others. It's good practice. Then the third is refraining from any kind of sexual conduct, erotic behavior, intentional kind of erotic behavior, so that we'll keep the vow of celibacy during this next 10 days. Then the fourth is refraining from using vain speech, lying, gossip, and so forth. But this will be noble silence, so that one is quite well covered. So, but noble silence means that you can speak if when I ask you a question, you can answer it. When they have an interview or something, you can talk to me. If the house catches on fire, you can yell for help. If you have a problem with anything and you need something, then you can talk to Martina, and or who's the I'm allowed to talk to you. Or who's the
Maria Petri.
Maria. But don't go and just use any old excuse to talk to Maria. Then also remember, noble silence, that people are trying to keep it. So, but sometimes it's very difficult if somebody else talks to us. We have to be very, we feel that we're rude if we don't answer. So remember to be responsible for not drawing somebody into conversation that maybe they really don't want to be part of, but you might unconsciously do that, and respect the rights of those around you and their attempts to keep silence. Watch the impulse to want to talk, because talking is a great release of a lot of repressed feelings. So like when people in ordinary life have a lot to complain about, complaining is a way of releasing tension. So that when we can't complain about something, when we're quiet, we find maybe all these tensions arising. So, and that's what you want. You want them. You want to look at these things rather than just habitually, just follow the habits of your lifetime. You want to see the way your mind works and what you've been doing during your life, so you can understand. So that we're limiting ourselves in this way, so that we can't just follow habit. We have to kind of stop and say, "Well, I can't do that now. I've taken these precepts." So, and then watch what happens, so that you begin to observe the conditions of your mind and let them go. So that you're, through mindfulness, you're letting things go in a skillful way, rather than just a habitual, heedless way. You're learning how to skillfully let things go, rather than just habitually repress and carry on in ways that keep binding us to suffering. Then the fifth precept is to refrain from taking drugs, like the hallucinogenic drugs and addictive drugs, and drink, like spirits and alcohol and so forth. Then this is so that the people also let off a lot of repression through drinking. One way, I suppose Switzerland is as much, people drink as much as they do in England. People have to drink because alcohol allows you to say all the things you wouldn't dare say when you're sober. So they, in all societies, everywhere in the world, drinking is an important kind of part of it. It really, it's kind of a safety valve for most people, in which they can kind of relax and then say and act in ways that they wouldn't dare be able to do if they were not inebriated or under the influence of alcohol or drugs. But now we are trying to release tensions and repression through wisdom and watching rather than just drinking drugs is unskillful. It just makes you addicted and caught up and you don't get any wisdom from it. Then the last three, the sixth precept is vikala pochana, which means regarding food, be more disciplined in regards to food. So that just accept the food that is offered at the designated times rather than seeking food, going to restaurants, having supplies of food, munching away on this and that. So that you can, don't spend your time just looking for distraction through eating. That's another way that we distract ourselves when we get bored, depressed, is to start eating things. So accept just the food that's given here and watch your mind. If you, the food has been superb, actually. It's hard to watch one's mind when watching the food. Then the next one is a long one, Najakita Vasita Vasukatasana Malagantavi Lebana Taranamantana Vipusnatana. That's not English. And that's to refrain from dancing, singing, playing games, wearing cosmetics, and spending your time having your hair curled, polishing your nails. dressing up in fancy dress and so forth. Refrain from getting involved in that kind of activity. And game playing. So this is the kind of the one that you can't do anything fun rule. So that you're not allowed to have a good time here. And then the last one, mahasayana is refraining from sleeping in inappropriate times, seeking to escape through sleeping on high luxurious beds or extreme comfort, so that you're just accept the sleeping place you've been given and try not to spend the day sleeping. Sleep is another way out of everything, isn't it? One of our favorite ways is to just crash out and forget. If you can't eat, you can't sing and dance, you can't have sex, you can't take drugs, you can't do anything, then you can go to sleep at least. So So there's eight precepts. So are you sure you want to take these? But this is the form. It's a renunciate form. It's for what they call samanas. Samanas are those who are intending towards the spiritual goal. So samana are precepts are to always, say, guide one, to contain one's desires, to direct that energy that would go out into these other things towards spiritual development. So the eight precepts, like a container, it kind of holds you, keeps you from going out every which way. Like living here together, many people in one building, we can live very easily with each other because we're not demanding very much from each other. And so we have time for spiritual practice. If we didn't have the precepts, then it would be each person wanting to do what he or she wanted to do, which would affect, if we couldn't agree on the form we were going to use, we'd have just chaos, anarchy. This person would want to do this, and this person would want to do that, and there'd be arguments, quarrels. Who would have time for a meditation? So we all of us agree to follow, contain ourselves within this form, so that we can all live this time together and support each other in our spiritual life. Because most people don't have an opportunity to spend, say, 10 days just inclining to nibbana, to developing their spiritual life, as you well know. In lay life, there's so many things pulling you out into the worldly conditions all the time. So here we're trying to create an atmosphere and give you the opportunity to where you're not having to, the kind of tensions and demands made on you are not the kind that will be pulling you out, but they will be the kind that will be encouraging you to look inward, to watch, be aware. Ursi, could you ask for the eight precepts?
Oh, I don't remember. Mayam bhante disaranena saha atasilani yachama. Tutiyampi mayam bhante disaranena saha atasilani yachama. Tatiyampi mayam bhante disaranena saha atasilani yachama.
Now if you put your hands together, be prepared for the eight precepts. Repeat after me. Namo tassa.
Namo tassa.
Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Samma sambuddhassa.
Namo tassa.
Namo tassa. Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Samma sambuddhassa.
Samma sambuddhassa.
Namo tassa.
Namo tassa.
Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Samma sambuddhassa.
Samma sambuddhassa.
Bhutan.
Buddha.
Saranang gacchami.
Saranang gacchami.
Dhammang.
Dhammang.
Saranang gacchami.
Saranang gacchami.
Sanghang.
Sanghang.
Saranang gacchami.
Saranang gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Bhutang.
Bhutang.
Saranang gacchami.
Saranang gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Dhammang.
Dhammang.
Saranang gacchami.
Saranang gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Sangham.
Sangham.
Saranangachami.
Saranangachami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Bhutang.
Bhutang.
Saranangachami.
Saranangachami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Dhammang.
Dhammang.
Saranangachami.
Saranangachami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Sangham.
Sangham.
Saranangachami.
Saranangachami.
So now you have taken the three refuges. And now the precepts. Banadibata.
Banadibata.
Veramani.
Veramani.
Sikabadang.
Sikabadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Adinadana.
Adinadana.
Veramani.
Veramani.
Sikabadang.
Sikabadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Abrahmacharya.
Abrahmacharya.
Veramani.
Veramani.
Sikabadang.
Sikabadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Mutsavada.
Mutsavada.
Veramani.
Veramani.
Sikabadang.
Sikabadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Surameraya.
Surameraya.
Machabama.
Machabama.
Tatana.
Tatana.
Veramani.
Veramani.
Sikabadang.
Sikabadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Vikalapochana.
Vikalapochana.
Veramani.
Veramani.
Sikabadang.
Sikabadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Najakita.
Najakita.
Vatita Vitsuka.
Vatita Vitsuka.
Dasana.
Dasana.
Malakanta.
Malakanta.
Vilebana.
Vilebana.
Tarana.
Tarana.
Mantana.
Mantana.
Vipusanatana.
Vipusanatana.
Veramani.
Veramani.
Sikabadang.
Sikabadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Ujjayasayana.
Ujjayasayana.
Mahasayana.
Mahasayana.
Veramani.
Veramani.
Sikabadang.
Sikabadang.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
Imani.
Imani.
Atasikabadani.
Atasikabadani.
Samadhiyami.
Samadhiyami.
There. No. Or in the form of the, you're now in the samana vehicle. You're riding in the samana vehicle. A vehicle is like a car, isn't it? Like you, to carry you somewhere, so that if you have a good vehicle, then you can kind of depend on it, and you don't have to spend your time doing all kinds of things or getting lost on the path. You just put yourself in a good vehicle, and then it takes you to where you're going, and you just can sit and watch. So now you're in this eight precept vehicle. Now the real practice is to sit and watch, stand and watch, walk and watch, lay down and watch, be mindful. And now the vehicle itself, you don't have to, whether you like it or not doesn't matter, whether you approve of it, all of it, it doesn't matter, because you're watching your mind. It's not up to you to try to get the, say if you're riding in a Renault or something in the youth. I don't want a Renault, I want a Rolls Royce or a Mercedes. Just ride in this one that you're in now and see if it gets you anywhere. Than thinking I'd rather have another one. If you do think that, then watch that. Recognize the conditions of your mind. The discontentment, the struggle, the resistance. Now, in any kind of restrictive form, there's going to be natural resistance to it. When you're in, say, keeping precepts, keeping silent, you have a schedule, you have to get up in the morning and and then sit for, and then do these various things. Everything is kind of ordered, and everything is itemized. And they do this time at that time. And so there's resistance to that too. So recognize, you want to look at that resistance. You want to recognize that. It's only for 10 days, but so you have a chance to watch suffering and the, how the mind kind of resists authority or a structure imposed over it. Now this is important because we need to learn to surrender, to relax, to let go. As long as this, the form is not based on any kind of exploitive or evil actions. So you're not asked to, they're all based on morality, on what is considered moral by wise people in the world. So that we're not, you'll not be asked to do anything that would be immoral or evil or cruel, anything like this. If our Venerable Nanda asks you to kill somebody, steal something, then you say, I'm sorry, Venerable Sumato, I would break my precepts if I... So it's your, it's kind of your protection from the from unscrupulous gurus. if we ask you to break your precepts, you say no. that's your guideline, you're right. And so the rest of it, like the meditation, the schedule, all this is based on the precepts to keep that form. So what you know, what you do now is watch your mind, like any feeling of resentment of authority or being told what to do or having to conform to something that you didn't design yourself. And we have to conform our activities to something imposed on us from someone else. We feel a resistance or aversion arising. When we, like sitting in meditation, when you can't get up when you want to, or so forth, you feel aversion arising. Sometimes we resent, like I used to feel that a lot in Thailand, when I went to stay with Ajahn Chah. He used to make me sit for hours like this. This kind of, the Thais like to sit in this polite posture. I found it very painful to sit like this for 5 minutes. And he used to make us sit for something like 2 or 3 hours like that. And my knees would be, I'd be going, getting really angry. I noticed that I directed that anger at him. I used to sit there and I used to just feel such hatred for him. And then I would think, I'm not going to stay here. I don't have to do this. I'll show him. I'm going to leave. But I didn't. I watched that kind of aversion and anger. Well, pain, when you're in pain, you get angry. If you can't, put in a position where you can't do what you want, or you feel you can't do, or you're afraid of what others will think, or you're trying to, you know, there's so many things here that we can learn from living in a community, from having authority figures, monks and lay people, from having disciplined rules and a disciplined life, where we can't get drunk, can't complain about things, we can't distract ourselves with television or games. We come and we sit together, stand together, walk together, eat together, and all this. But we watch. So we're bringing our attention to our mind, what goes on inside us. Because we're trying to watch what happens to us, rather than just follow habit. You're studying habit. You're watching it, listening to it. So you begin to have a perspective on the conditioning that you've acquired up to now. So this form isn't just a kind of reconditioning process. We're not trying to make you into Buddhists or into any. We're not trying to make you believe in anything. There's nothing that you have to believe in. Like the three refuges of Buddha Dhamma Sangha isn't a belief. It's a practical kind of statement of one's intentions to be wise, to use wisdom, to take refuge in what is the truth, and in virtue. But it's not a kind of, it's not a like Buddhist belief. So you're not asked to believe in Buddha or believe in any kind of Buddhist teachings, but to take the teachings and use them in order to watch and learn and listen. So the Buddhist meditation teachings are all designed to kind of get you to look at yourself, ways of perceiving, ways of watching, so that you begin to understand that the Buddha wisdom is the simple wisdom that all that arises passes away. And if it arises and passes away, it's not yours. It's not what you are. You're not a condition that arises and passes away. And then you say, well, then what am I? And this is the ultimate question. Maybe by the end of the retreat or somewhere, you might actually begin to know who you are. But you have to. You can only know who you are when you know what you're not. So we start. Then we start with examining what we are not, and this is what we're doing when we're seeing the conditions of our bodies and minds, feelings, thoughts, memories, opinions, views, all these are conditioned, they're conditioned into you. They're not ultimate realities. They're conditioned into you by your society, families. So that where we take them quite, we quite believe in them as being our personalities, ourselves. Now we're looking at them not as our personal kind of possessions, but as conditioned perceptions. We're breaking through this habitual grasping of perception to understand the truth, to begin to recognize the ultimate truth, which is always here now, but which we don't recognize because we're so busy with all these conventional things. Caught up in our feelings, in our emotions, in our habits, likes and dislikes, and fears, doubts and worries. Who has time to ever recognize anything other than just being caught up in the momentum of habit? Until you take time, you have to make the time, you have to turn to the truth. You have to make that, it doesn't, the truth doesn't come and zap you. Not just truth, like God standing up there and saying, wake up, you so-and-so. You have to turn, you have to look, you have to listen, you have to put forth the effort yourself. So that's what we mean by practice meditation, being mindful. Mindfulness is really a turning to the truth. It's not a rejection of the world. It's not that you're going to pass judgment on the world and reject it and say, I don't want anything more to do with the world. Don't like it. And go off and live in a kind of special celestial realm. That doesn't happen. But you're seeing the world as it really is, rather than as you perceive it, as you've been conditioned to perceive the world. You're using wisdom rather than desire in your life. All of you have wisdom. There's not one person here that is lacking wisdom. It's just a matter of using it, is all. So in meditation, we're using wisdom. We're not acquiring it. It's not something you get through meditation. It's something you use to meditate with. Now, meditation is a completely different attitude is necessary than that worldly attitudes you have in your mind. Like when you come here, you have your mind's conditioned to say, think in all the attitudes of your worldly habits, which might be all right for worldly conditions, but are obstacles for Dhamma, for the truth. So take the worldly habit of thinking, if I practice now hard, then sometime in the future I will become something. It's like going to university. If I study diligently in 3 or 4 years, I will attain my university degree, which is true on a conventional level, isn't it? We all have been through that. You don't start out with a university degree. You start out with doing something and going along for a few years to attain it. That's the world. That's the world of birth and death, of division, of discrimination. Now the attitude, so the attitude of a worldly person is one of doing something and expecting a result in the future. So that worldly people are always expecting things. They think, I have to do this now. I have to get rid of my lazy habits, and I have to get rid of all my bad things in order to become this kind of saint in the future. So we oftentimes live our lives with this kind of always trying to get rid of things. We see weaknesses, faults, fears and all this, and we're trying to get rid of those things because they're inhibiting, causing us so that a lot of misery, blocking us in our pursuit of happiness or success, worldly success. So in order to be really happy, you have to get rid of unhappiness, and this is the worldly attitude. Now the Dharma attitude for meditation is, rather than doing something now to attain something in the future, it's a being, like being wise now. using wisdom now, not meditating now, hopefully to gain wisdom by the end of the retreat. That's a worldlier. That doesn't help, really. What you need to develop to just now reflect on this attitude of now being using wisdom, meaning being aware, looking at the conditions that arise in your consciousness. Now, using wisdom now doesn't mean you're going to become wise in the future, it means you're being wise now. So it's an attitude of being rather than of becoming. So Buddhist meditation is a very direct kind of practice. It's even being enlightened now. And you think, if you read Buddhist books too much, you think, there's no chance for enlightenment in this lifetime. It's so difficult to do that, you know, you'll probably have to be reborn I don't know how many more times before you'll ever get even near to it. That's how books tend to make it sound. And even in countries like Thailand and Sri Lanka, they talk like that. Some monks in Thailand will even say, there's no point in even trying now, and the day is gone. The day, that era where people were enlightened is over. Now this is the Kali Yuga. We can only just hope to be maybe reborn again in a Deva realm or something. So when Ajahn Chah would hear this, hear monks talk like this, he said, well then why did you ordain? Why did you ordain as a monk? Because when you ordain as a monk, you say, I ordain as a monk to go to Nibbana. So it's a direct thing. You're going, inclining to Nibbana. The whole point of monastic life, of a Buddhist monk, is to incline to Nibbana. It's not to be reborn in the next life as a Devada. So this is where traditional religion is really, has lost the spirit, has lost the essence of Buddhist teaching. Because it makes it sound too difficult, too remote a possibility. Something that takes lifetimes of being reborn into this and that before you can ever possibly be enlightened. But if you really understand Buddhist teaching, Buddha didn't teach like that at all. It's not becoming enlightened, it's being enlightened. So it's always being. It's not finding Buddhas, but being Buddha, being wisdom. It's not thinking you're Buddha, but it's being that Buddha wisdom. This is a completely different, mind-blowing attitude to Western mind. You think, well, I have to do all kinds, I've got these. I've got a bad temper, I'm greedy, I have a lot of fear. And how can I be a Buddha if I have all these things? I've got terrible habits, I've done some really wretched things in the past, and, how can I ever hope to be a Buddha when I've got so many faults and weaknesses? So you think like that, you know, it seems hopeless. But being Buddha means being that knowing those thoughts as thoughts. Those feelings that you somehow have so many faults, so many weaknesses, so many defects that you couldn't possibly hope to ever get near to it in this lifetime. You recognize that's conditioned perception, that's thinking, and that's being Buddha. Buddhas know that conditions as the conditions. That's all. Buddhas are very simple beings. It's that knowing that the conditions of your mind are conditions of your mind. It's not believing that those conditions are yours anymore. So what you think you are is a condition. It's a condition of your mind. It's thought. It's not the ultimate truth. It's not Buddha. So in meditation, Buddhist meditation is that direct. It's actually a being, being awake, being mindful, listening, being attentive. So, like we sit and we, when we meditate, we aren't going out playing games, reading books, dancing, singing, drinking, sleeping, chatting, going out hunting, skiing, fishing, but we're sitting looking, like we sit here and we can shut our eyes, we don't have anything to look at. Not much. Nobody's dressing up to make themselves incredibly alluring, so that there's no, nobody to really worth looking at now. Venerable Nanda lies sitting here, aren't worth looking at. So there's nothing to bother to look at but yourself. So you're sitting here looking, watching, listening, being attentive to whatever comes, whatever happens. It doesn't matter what it is. If it moves and changes, it's you're aware of it. If it's good, pleasant, or if it's horrible or nasty, if it's a good feeling, if it's a murderous feeling, like you want to murder me, that's all right. You still just recognize it as a condition. Don't do it because you've got the precept. That's why I have to give these precepts. So that you, if you feel like murdering me, just recognize that as a feeling. Let it go, don't do it. All these things, you're free to think what you want. Or what comes up, not what you want, but what comes up. Allow you're opening the mind to allow things to just appear. Things that before, you know, under certain conditions, you think, oh, I shouldn't be thinking like that. You're thinking, maybe Ajahn Sumedho can read minds. And you think, I'm sitting up here reading everything that's going through your mind. But I can't read minds, so you don't have to worry about it. So whatever comes up in your mind, is you only you know. And that's for you to know that is a condition. Just to recognize conditions as conditions. You don't have to figure out, why do I think like that? Why do I have thoughts like that? And then you start to think, well, because when I was a child, my mother dropped me on my head. The concussion always made me, I've always resented that. And that, because now I have this problem. And you just think about yourself again, don't you? So this is just bare attention on conditions. One time in London, a woman used, when we lived in Hampstead, a woman that used to come there almost every night. She was a middle-aged English woman who liked to think of herself as a kind of mother. Earth Mother, very maternal kind of woman. And she always, you know, the image she had of herself is one that was always loving everybody. So she always talked about love and loving everything. And then one day she came to the Vihara in London and she was really upset. And she said, I'm really, it's terrible. She said, I don't know what's happened to me. She said, My daughter-in-law, my son's wife, just had a baby, and the first grandchild. And I went to see the baby for the first time, and I picked it up, and this thought came to mind, I want to poke its eyes out. And she said, I was so horrified by this thought that I had to leave. And she said, why would I think a thought like that? What's wrong? What's wrong with me that I would think something like that? And I said, you didn't do it, did you? And she said, well, no, of course not. Well, it's just a thought that comes. If you try to think out why would I think, you start analyzing, just recognize that the condition is a thought. the thought is a condition. It's something you don't do. If you have thoughts like that, just don't act on them. Let them go. But also, it's obvious, isn't it? Someone that's trying so desperately to be maternal, obviously trying to cover up a lot of hostility. But then, you know, then she'll stay. If I told her that, she'd start thinking about herself a lot, which she already does too much. Thinks about herself, tries to figure herself out all the time. Where the real help comes in recognizing conditions and letting them go, not creating complications around things. Recognize that you might have evil thoughts, but just you don't act on them. It's something you refrain from doing. So if you want to steal something, don't go spend the time worrying about being a thief. But just recognize that that's something you don't do. Sexual thoughts, just recognize those are conditions of the mind rather than personal problems. All these things, you're recognizing conditions of the mind as conditions rather than as personal problems, personality problems, as me and mine, as a neurotic hang-up, as a terrible fault and flaw with me, me and mine. Don't do that. Don't fall for that anymore. But recognize. So then it's a genuine opening of the mind, so you feel a freedom to let these things come up into consciousness. Because there's a lot that we do not allow ourselves to consciously, to arise in our consciousness. We have a kind of repressive mechanism, that there's a lot that we have to keep away all the time. We won't allow it to come into consciousness. Now, being conscious of something means to allow something to come up so you see it directly when you're fully conscious of it. But say hatred, lust, things like this, a lot of it, we never allow into our consciousness. It only comes when we're completely heedless, like drunk or asleep or something. When you're asleep, you have oftentimes weird, horrible dreams, don't you? Really awful things happen. Because you're not filtering, you're not repressing anything. So in sleep, what you wouldn't be able to allow in consciousness arises in dreams. The release also, I think experiments one time where they'd wake people just before they started dreaming, and they became very, very neurotic. They couldn't get through their dreams, which are released, you see. But now, in meditation, you're releasing the irrational, repressed conditions in a skillful way, by allowing them to come into consciousness and letting them go. So that's why the Buddhist teaching of anatta, or not-self, is so helpful, because if you think these are yours, then of course there's a lot of things you just couldn't bear to identify with, of thoughts and feelings that you just, you know, if you thought, is that what you really are? You'd think you were a really horrible being. But when you can recognize it's just consciousness, sensory consciousness is not a person, not a self, it's a condition in nature that is not you, not what you are, then you're not afraid to allow repressed things to arise into consciousness. Because when you do that, you let them go. It's the catharsis, the kind of release or purification of the mind. But it's skillful, because it's done with wisdom, not with desire or repression. Wisdom is being used. And it takes you to the truth. All these things, as you begin to purify the mind, relieve it of all its repressions, open it, cleanse it, you know the true thing. You are your true nature, your true self, which is not conditioned, the unconditioned. So, that's why in what happens here, is don't be like, be quite brave. Allow things, it's an opening, a liberating, even though on one level it looks terribly restrictive, don't you? You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't talk. You're being contained physically and verbally. Mentally, you're being freed. Physically, you can't do this, you can't do that. Verbally, you can't, if you hate somebody, you can't say it. But you can recognize it. So that you're not doing anything to hurt anyone else. Right? But you're not repressing it. So if you hate anybody here, just don't say it. Don't say, I hate you. But bring it up into consciousness. Recognize hatred as a condition and then it let it go. So that you're letting go of aversion and hatred without creating more habits around it. When you're willing to do that, then your karmic patterns begin to cease. Your habitual hang-ups. Your obsessions, well, these begin to cease, they begin to fade away. You begin to feel a relief of not being, and begin to recognize the joy that comes from liberation, of not being just a bound, limited, conditioned creature of habit, a helpless victim of fate. Now, how many of you here have feel that your lives, you're just kind of hopeless, or that you're too limited, or that maybe you've ruined your life, or that your life is pointless, and so forth. This is very strong in people, because they've not used wisdom. So in the talks that I give, and in the meditation, is all to encourage you. I can't make you use wisdom. It's something you have to use. I can't give you wisdom. It's something you have to use. And you do it by watching and listening, recognizing, being very, very patient, humble, humility, very willing to learn from even the nastiest conditions in your mind. Willing to learn the ultimate truth through the most humble kind of conditions, rather than thinking, I've got to have the best teacher, the best conditions. For me, I'm the kind of conceit, isn't it? I have to have the very best of everything. But say, here, just see what you can do under the conditions you find yourself. How many of you have you all practiced meditation before? I think so. Is there anyone who's never done any? So you're all old hands. Makes it easier. So now if you'll just kind of stretch your legs and a bit, we'll have a sitting meditation.